Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Mem Tet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah, as the previous Gemara indicated, is based off of the previous Mishnah. It's actually nothing to do with Masechet Nidah, but it has to do with a genre of comparisons, contrasts that are made in the Mishnah, and that's what the Gemara ended off with before, which is why did the Mishnah at the beginning of the Perek repeat this position of Ef Shar, that there's no possibility that the upper simanim come before the lower simanim. And the Mishnah ends with the fact that Ibnei Shamru, Efshar Latachton Navo, Ajlo Bailayon, it's possible that the lower simanim can precede the upper simanim. They don't have to be coincident indicators. About Efshar Leilion Navo, Ajlo Batachton. But it's impossible that the upper simanim would precede the lower simanim. So you have a contrast and a comparison between the two structures. And that's exactly what the structure of the upcoming Mishnayot are like. All about issues that have nothing to do with Nidah, but structurally are similar, which is Kiyotzebo, Kol Kli Cheres, Shu Machnis, Motzi. Any Kli Cheres that can allow liquids in, allows liquids out. Vieshim Motzi, there are certain items that let liquids out, Ve'enu Machnis, but it does not let liquids in. We're going to see in the Gemara in a second what the ramifications of that are, but these are determinations in terms of the usability, the utility, the tuma, the shem kli that is associated with these items. And there are two different tests that are mentioned here. There's a test of the ability of liquids to enter from the outside versus a test of liquids that are internal to the kli that they seep out. And obviously, to allow liquids in from the outside, you would need a bigger hole than you would need for liquids to drip or to leak out of something that has liquids internal. And so these are different standards with regards to the shem kli of a kli cheres. And all the Mishnah is saying is that, obviously, if it's big enough to allow liquids in, then it's certainly big enough to allow liquids out. But there's a possibility that it could let liquids out and not let liquids in. Kol eiver sheyesh bo tziporen, any limb that has a nail on it, yesh bo etzem, then for sure it has a bone in it. Yesh bo etzem ve'ein bo tziporen. And there are sometimes we have a limb that has a bone in it, but it doesn't have a tziporen. It doesn't have a nail. Again, in the Gemara, we will speak about the ramifications of this. What are the nafkaminot between whether it has a nail or doesn't have a nail? Rashi over here points out something that will become more obvious when we get to the Gemara, that we're speaking about an etzba yitera. We're speaking about not a regular finger, but an additional finger on the hand, a sixth finger on the hand. And we'll discuss exactly what is the structure of that finger. And what the Mishnah is indicating is that there's a different status to a finger or an extra finger that has a nail on it versus one that simply has a bone associated with it. And that is because when it comes to tumat hamet, by tumat hamet, a bone only has to be etzem kisseora, which has to be the size of a barley seed in order to convey tuma, but that is tumat maga and masa. In order for there to be tumat ohel, you need a minimum of a kezayit basar in order for there to be tumat ohel. There is an exception to the rule, and that's the exception that we saw actually in the Gemara in the last perek of Eiver. When you have a whole limb, as we noted in the previous perek, there is no minimum shiur, because the limb itself is chashuv and accomplishes whatever minimum shiur you need is automatically reached by the fact that there is chashivut to a whole Eiver. And the question here is this an Eiver, or is this simply a part of a corpse? So if it's just simply a part of a corpse, then it would have to meet all the threshold shiurim. And then in order to be mitame maga masa, all you need is etzem kisse ora. In order for there to be tumat oil, you need a kezayit basar. On the other hand, if it is an aver, then you don't need to meet all the minimum shiurim, and there would still be tumat oil, despite the fact that you do not have a shiur of kezayit basar over here. As well as the fact, obviously, that there will be tumat maga umasa with regards to this aver. The next item that's mentioned in the Mishnah is kol mitamei midras, mitamei tamei meit. Anything that can accept tuma is affected by the tuma of mishkav and moshav. So for instance, we've spent a lot of time in this with regards to a zav and a zava nida. If they sit on an object, they make that object into an avatuma. If they lay on an object, they make that object into an avatuma. Not only do they affect the item that they're on, they affect items that are below that item as well. So they have this ability to convey tuma through midras, which it literally means to step on or to put pressure on. Over here it has implications to a broad range of tumot that all come from the individual who is tamei being on top of whatever the object is, whether they're lying on the object, sitting on the object, standing on the object. That conveys tuma at a very high level. It conveys tuma to the point where the object itself is an avatuma. What it says is, if the kli that they are on has the ability to accept tumat midras, then it also has the ability to accept tumat hamet. It's a kli for midras, then it's also a kli for tumat hamet. On the other hand, yesh mitamet hamet, there are instances where an object can have tumat hamet associated with it, meaning that if an avia both the tumat, which is the mate, comes into contact with it, it will make it tamet. Veinu mitamet midras. On the other hand, it will not have tumat midras. Again, we'll see this in the Gemara, that there are certain kelim that are not made to be sat on. They are kelim that are made not to lay on. Those kelim do not accept tumat midras, even if you sit on them, or even if you lay on them. Rashi over here notes that the truth is that this is true for a broad range of tumot. You didn't need to bring tumat amet. If you say it's mitameh midras, it's also mitameh all the other types of tumah that come about, not just tameh tumat amet. And Rashi says that the Mishnah picked tumat amet because both of them generate an avatuma, and that is midras generates an avatuma on the object upon which it is sat or laid upon. So too, tumatamet creates an avatuma out of the kli. And so the only reason the Mishnah used these two items is to say that whatever through midras makes an avatuma, so too through tumatamet can make an avatuma. But that's not to preclude other types of tuma which are an avatuma and would make it into a rishon the tuma. It would also be true there as well. So if a sheretz touches a kli that had the zav sat on it or laid on it would have tumat midras, that kli is enough of a kli that if a sheretz puts an avat tumah, touches it, it will become a rishon the tumah. Because the Mishnah used parallel tumot of avat tumah and avat tumah, but not to say that that's the exclusive range of where this is true. So now the Gemara discusses piece by piece each one of the items in the Mishnah. It says, machnis, if liquids can enter into the kli from the outside, pasul the mei chatat, then you can no longer use it as a kli to be mikadesh the mei chatat. The mei chatat are the ashes of the paraduma, and there it says you have to go maim chaim el keli. You have to take live spring water and put it into a kli. That kli then is what you put the ashes into. That kli, if it's kones mashke, it has a hole big enough to allow liquids to come in from the outside, then it's no longer ra'ui to use to be mekadesh to mei chatat because it's no longer considered to be a kli. Upasul mishum gistera. And that would be true even if it was a shard of pottery as well. We'll get back to that in 1 second. Tosafot over here raises the issue that with regards to the kiddush of mei chatat, regards to the making of the ashes, the paraduma, and then putting them into the waters to make the mechatat, the Gemara in Yoma says that the paraduma was all done with either clay galalaim, clay avanim, clay adama, all types of utensils that are not mikabel tuma. So then why are you speaking about kli cheres over here, which seems to be the topic of the Mishnah and where these shiurim are relevant? We don't even use kelim that are mikabel tuma. Why is this even relevant to the story of mechatat? So there are a number of answers given. The Balei Tosafot themselves say that that is only with regards to the Sreifata Para. That's with the creation of the ashes of the Para Duma. That's where we have that high level of Tahara that is used, that we don't use Kelim to become Tamei. And that is because of the offsetting factor, which is that we make the Kohen Gadol into a Tvul Yom in order to show the Din of Para Duma can be done with Tvul Yom, which the tzukim say that it can't be done. So they used to intentionally be mitameyim kitvul yom in order to demonstrate that. To offset that leniency, they were very makpid on everything else, that it be super tahor, and that means that they only use kelim. Over here, we're not in the process of making the paraduma. This is in the processing of Demei Chatat. So other Rishonim give similar answers, which are that either that's only true with regards to the processing of the Chatat, not in the making of the Mei Chatat. That's another way you could have distinguished, which is over there, it's about making the Parah Aduma, making the ashes. Over here, it's about putting the ashes into the water. So those are two different processes, and over here, you don't have that requirement of Klei Avanim, Klei Gelalim, and so on and so forth. You do have that requirement by the making of the Parah Aduma, the ashes of the Parah Aduma. So that's a similar answer to what the Balei Tosafot are saying. The Balei Tosafot are saying, because of the Kula, by the creation of the ashes, you need that. You could just make the distinction, period, that there are two different processes, and you separate between them. It also could be a difference between the Doraita level mitzvah, which could be done in a Kli Cheres, versus the Maila de Rabbanan that requires you to do with kelim that are not Mikabel Tuma. So those are ways to distinguish between that which is said in Masechet Yumah and that which is said over here. Then the Gemara continues and says, Motzi, if it has a hole that allows liquids out, kasher the mechatat, then it's still a kli in order to be mekadesh the mechatat, the ashes and the waters of the Parah Aduma in it. Upasul mishum gistira, and it is problematic in terms of a shard of pottery. Amar Rav Asi, shonim kli cheres, shi'uro bikones mashke. We learn by kli cheres that the shear for a kli cheres is kones mashke, where liquids are allowed to or can enter from the outside. But we only have this shiur of motzi mashke that it leaches liquids with regards to a shard of pottery. My taima, what's the reason? Amar mzutra breder of Nachman, the fish ain't omrim, have a gistera le gistera. We don't say bring a shard for a shard. So now the discussion here revolves around dinim of kelim and tuma. In Masechet Kelim, we have all different types of kelim that are mentioned there. It's clear here that we're speaking about kli cheres, and the kli cheres has particular rules as to what makes it into a kli or what disqualifies it from being a kli. If you have a kli cheres that is whole, whatever it is, a pitcher, a utensil of any sort that's made out of pottery, made out of clay. So that kli has the same kli for items that require a kli. It also has the same kli with regards to tum'ah, which is that if something touches it, it will become tameh. You can ruin the same kli. And that again, Masechet Kelim is full of this, that certain problems with the kli will disqualify it from being a kli, or also will make it that it's no longer got a same kli, and it will not accept tumah, or if it was tameh, it may no longer be tameh, it will be tahor. So if you have a regular kli cheres, what it's saying here is that a kli cheres that has a hole in it, it's a regular pitcher, it's a regular cup, it's a regular basin that's made out of cheres, and then it has a hole at the bottom. What size of hole changes it from being a kli into an ois kli, into no longer being a kli? What the Mishnayot in Kelim tell us is that the machnis mashke, that if the waters could enter from the outside externally into the kli, it no longer has the same kli. That has ramifications for, first of all, anything that requires a kli, this item will no longer be able to be used for that. So that's the example of mechatat. You need kiddush b'kli. So if you have machnis mashke, a hole the size of machnis mashke, it will be disqualified from that. In addition, if this kli cheres was tamei, it would no longer be tameh, because you've ruined it. You have changed its status from being a kli to being not a kli anymore. In addition, if it wasn't tameh yet, it will not be mikabel tumah, because it's not a kli, and you need something to be a kli in order to accept tumah. That is all true with regards to a machnis mashke. If it simply has a hole the size that allows it to drip out or to leach liquids, that's not enough of a hole to disqualify it from being used as a utensil. Since it's not enough to disqualify it from being utensil, then number one, it can be used for kiddush mechatat. Number two, it would be mikabel tumah. Number three is, if it is tameh, it still will remain tameh. Now the reason being, and that comes out of what we see here later on, is that because when you have a small hole in the utensil, the person is chas alav. Person doesn't want to get rid of it. He doesn't want to ruin something that was made, something that he paid money for. He can understand from this the type of lifestyle and poverty maybe that they were living with. But a person doesn't just throw out something because it has a small hole in it. What you do is you bring a small shard of pottery or some other item under it, and you put it there to capture whatever leaks out of the main kli. For instance, it would be the equivalent today of what we have when you have a planter. And you put a base under the planter because the planter has holes in it to allow the water to drain out of it. Then you put something underneath it to capture the water that drains out of it. So similarly over there, if they had a hole in the kli charis, they would bring a piece of pottery or something else, either to patch it, to capture the liquids that were leaking out of it. In Masechet Kelim, it also notes that if you have a kli that breaks down into pieces, then those pieces, as long as they can capture a liquid in them and can stand up, meaning that they can sit on a flat surface and they will maintain their integrity of shape, they have a Beit Kibul, they have an area that can accept liquids into it, then the item remains active or remains that it has a Shem Kli on it, and that Shem Kli will make it that it will be Mikabel Tuma, or if it was Tame, it will not lose its Shem Tuma. And the Gemara in Chulin, as Rashi notes, lays out a ratio between what the original size of the kli is and how much in the shards a residual Beit Kibul needs to be in relationship to the original kli for it to still be classified as something that has utility that people would keep and would retain its Shem Kli or Tuma. So now you have even something bigger than this, which is that even if you smash the kli cheres, each piece that's there can now accept Tuma, or if it was Tameh before, seemingly, and I'll discuss it in a second, it will remain Tameh because it still has its original utility associated with it. So that item now, or those shards of pottery, since they are functional, they will be Mikabel Tuma. They will have a Shem Kli on them, in a sense, because they have a Beit Kibul. The way to ruin that is to have a hole in it that leaks, or leaches out liquids. And that was what the Gemara just said now. Why is the standard by a shard of pottery different than a kli or a whole kli? And that's the difference that Rabbi Yassi notes. When you have a whole kli, then a person says, listen, I have a whole kli here. I'm not going to waste it. I'm not going to throw it out. I'll find a little shard or I'll find something to capture whatever leaks out of it because it's a big kli. I'm not going to get rid of it. But if you have a shard of pottery that you're using already and it gets a hole in it, you don't bring another shard of pottery to help out with the shard that is leaking. It's already a shard of pottery, and now that it's leaking, it's worthless, and therefore you would throw it out. So that's the difference in standard for a gistera versus a whole kli. As the Balei Tosfot point out, that the word gistera, Rabbeinu Chananel explains that gistera hu shever v'lashon lavan. It is a shard in Greek. V'nira de'ein shever kli cheres tamei mishum gistera. This is something that the Balei Tosfot would say in a number of places in Shas. This is their view with regards to these matters. And that is that if the kli breaks apart into shards, I said before that it may maintain its tuma because the items are still functional. The Balei Tosfot over here have a qualification of that. And that would mean that by design or by default, if the kli breaks into pieces, it's tahor. Just like if it had a hole in it, the size that would allow liquids in, so too, if it breaks into pieces, it is tahor. Those shards of pottery only have a shame kli on them, or can be mekabel tuma, if you, after the fact, or after it's broken, you decide to use them, that you make them into something that has utility, then your designation has significance. And the Balei Tosfot speak to other situations. We spoke about, first of all, in the Gemara in Chulin. It's also found in the Gemara in Shabbat. The Balei Tosfot mentioned this in a number of places, which is that if you have a kli that gets a hole in it, v'kones mashkeh, it's no longer usable for liquids, and therefore it's no longer tameh. But there, the Mishnayot and the Gemara brings this idea that then you could use it for olives. If you store olives in it, now it would also be mikabel tuma, because olives don't fall out of that size hole. If you have a kli cheres that has a hole the size of an olive, so then you won't use it for olives, you'll use it for pomegranates, which are bigger. You'll keep using it for bigger and bigger items that are not affected by the hole. What the Balei Tosfot say is, it doesn't mean that when you get the hole that size, that it doesn't remove the Shem Kli. It removes the Shem Kli, and you need to designate it each time to bear its alternate usage. But if you do designate it for its alternate usage, then it can be Mekabel Tuma prospectively, but it will not be connected to the original Kli. The original Kli is no longer has its utility, and it is Tahor. Tosafot says, if that's the case, what's the Chiddush? Of course, if you designate it for something that has utility and it can't be used for, it becomes a Kli. Why is that a Chiddush based on what the Gemara says, that you can go from a smaller hole to a bigger hole to a bigger hole, and each time you find a new utility for the Kli? So Tosafot says that's only if you designate the Kli to be used that way. Why is that a Chiddush? That seems pretty obvious. So what the Baalei Tosafot say is that these types of utility are considered to be normal usage of the Kli, and therefore Ein B'Teila Dato Etzel Kol Adam. We don't say that this person's unusual or this person's an oddity, and therefore we're not going to have his mindset affect the Kli. So that's how he explains over here about the shard of pottery, why even if you do utilize it afterwards, even if it has a hole in it and you decide to use it and put another shard on it, doesn't matter because Beish Lamar Dain Derechli Achid Shever Katan Abami Kli Gadol Ubetela Dato Etzel Kol Bnei Adam. That's not a normal usage. That's not normal utility. That's not the way normal people function. And therefore, even if you designate it, your designation is annulled because normal people don't act that way. Since normal people don't act that way, you can't create a shame kli out of something that people don't usually use for a kli. So what Tosafot says is the ideas that are proposed by those Gemarot in Chulin and Shabbat and the Mishnah in Kelim, which discusses this idea that you can transform a kli to a new utility, all of those include yichud, that you have to designate it for that particular utility, and it's as if it's a new kli when you do such. And the reason that we need to tell you that is that you're not unusual, or it's not something that's outrageous, and therefore when you make that designation, it does become a kli. So that's the one thing to note here. The second thing to note over here, which the Baalei Tosafot point out as well, which is that all of these dinim that we're mentioning over here seem to be uniquely associated with kli cheres and not with other kelim. That means this idea of kones mashkeh and motzi mashkeh is a din that applies to kli cheres, does not apply to other kelim. And the dinim that we're noting over here in terms of what we just said, the difference between a whole kli and a gistera, all of that seems to be uniquely associated with kli cheres. And that might be why the Gemara over here only mentioned Kli Cheres and didn't mention other Kelim, is because Kli Cheres has this unique aspect that the Gistra, that the shards are used. Other Kelim, when they break apart or they are ruined, people don't use the portion or the section of that Kli, but that is not true by Kli Cheres. And so Kli Cheres has a unique side to it because of Gistra, and therefore by other Kelim, the only relevant measure is Kones Mashkeh, not Motzi Mashkeh. Because by other kelim, you only have full utensils, you don't have these broken pieces of the utensils, which is the distinction that we're drawing between the kli cheres, which is a whole kli, and a shard, whereby the whole kli is disqualified or ruined only when it has a kones mashkeh, but the gistira, the shard, is ruined by motzi mashkeh. That's uniquely associated with kli cheres, because shards are something that by kli cheres have utility or maintain a certain amount of shame kli, which is not true by the shards or pieces of other kelim. That's a lot easier to understand according to the Rishonim that believe that the shards automatically remain or retain a shame kli when they break away from the kli cheres. As long as they still have utility, they can sit on their own face up and they have a beit kibul, then that's easier to understand, that distinction between kli cheres and other kelim. According to the view of the Baalei Tosafot, the Ra'avad, and others that believe that you need to be miyachedit in order for it to also be mekabel tuma, then that distinction isn't as fine because it would seemingly be true of other kelim, other materials as well, whereby if you have shards that you designate for utility, they would also have a din of kli, and therefore it's much harder or finer distinction between kli cheres and other utensils. And that's why the Gemara is mentioning kli cheres in particular, although the Baalei Tosafot do note over here that this does have broader application to other kelim. Even though our Gemara seems to be only speaking about kli cheres, the way end of the Baalei Tosafot on this amud, he says, Mikom akom had Rova, damar reper kol basar, Rova who speaks in Chulin about netilat yadayim, nikev bekonis mashkeh, if you have a kli that has a hole in it that allows liquids in, einot li meimeno li yadayim, you can't wash netilat yadayim with such a kli. The same disqualification we have here for a kli to be mekadesh mechatat is also the same disqualification for using that kli for netilat yadayim. Yesh lahachmir b'chol ha-kelim shenikvu kekones mashkeh. That is not only true by kli cheres. We should be machmir for any utensil, any material that has a hole in it, Mekonis Mashkeh, that Shalo Yitol Mehem, that you should not wash your hands from such a kli. Kevin Shalo Shizkir Sham Kli Cheres, Ela Kamar Kli Stam. He says the difference between our Gemara over here, which mentions the requirements over here, and the Mishnah says Kli Cheres, seems to be uniquely associated with Kli Cheres. Rova's statement in Chulin does not have the modifier of Kli Cheres. It just says Kli. And so the fact that Rova only mentioned Kli over there, and over here we mentioned Kli Cheres, so the dinim here are uniquely associated with Kli Cheres. But the din of Rova applies to all types of Kelim, and therefore, for Netilat Yadayim, we would disqualify any Kli that has a hole the size of a Machnis, Mashkeh, that allows liquids to enter from the outside. Tarabanan, Ketzad Bodkim Kli Cheres, Yadayim Mikev, Bekones Mashkeh, Imlav. How do I know that a Kli Cheres is a hole the size that will allow liquids to come in? Or it's only a bit motzi mashke. It's only big enough to allow liquids to leach out. Yavi areva le'amayim. You bring a big trough full of water. And then you put the kli in there. And you see when you're putting the kli in, meaning that you keep the top of the kli up above the level of the water, the base of the kli that has the hole in it, you start to depress that into the water. Im kansav yadua shekones mashke. And you see now if water enters into the kli internally, you'll know that it has a hole the size that allows water in. Bimalav, if not, be a dush motzi mashke. Then you know that the hole is not sufficiently big to allow liquids in, but it is big enough to allow liquids out. The difference has to do with the pressure and the amount of space that is there. If the hole is not big enough, the pressure of the water trying to enter through too small a space will not allow the water to enter. As opposed to when it's internal and it's dripping out, the liquids will leach out over time because not under that type of pressure in terms of entering in. It happens anytime you open up, for instance, a can and you're trying to pour out of a can. When you pour out of the can, the liquids come out, but it has to allow for air to go in order for the liquids to come out. So usually people punch a second hole in such a can to allow the liquids to flow easily and the air to come in. If you only leave one hole open, then you know when you pour the liquid out, the liquid comes out in sporadic and staccatic manner because it keeps needing to let the air back in to allow more liquid to come out because the liquid can only exit if air goes in. So there's a similar idea here with regards to liquids coming in from the outside of the kli that if there's not enough space to let air in and out, then the liquids themselves won't go into the kli, even though it will leak liquids out. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Kofef Oznek Teira L'Tocha, Umetzif Alea Mayim. Rabbi Yehuda doesn't say why he's not happy with the test that the Tanakhama lays out, but he offers an alternative test, and that is you turn the kli upside down in the trough, and then only afterwards do you pour water into the trough, and then you see if the water enters in, meaning that you have the water rise to above the level where the hole is in the kli, and you see if it leaks in. So he says you put it face down into the trough, so the face is sealed by the base of the trough, and then the hole, which is on the bottom of it, which is now facing up, now you put water into the trough until it floats above that hole, and you see if it enters. If water enters in or leaks in now, you know that it's the size of kones mashkeh. If not, then it is leaching outward. Rashi over here explains why Rabbi Yehuda rejected the test of the Tanakhama, and that is lo kach boinim ta'ata kulahu. The idi the dochik la shulaim ema aili maya legava. Because the way that you set up the test, you are giving an advantage to the fact that it will leak more easily. And that is because when you submerge the item under that type of pressure, the liquids are more likely to enter because of that submersion. It's different having liquids that are just floating above and then they're trying to get in versus when you are submerging the kli, pushing it in, that pressure itself might cause the mashke to go into the kli. And that is the reason why Rabbi Yehuda does not like the check of the Tanakhama, but rather prefers the check that he says, which is that you put it face down first, and then only afterwards do you add the liquids, rather than trying to submerge the kli when the liquids are already there. Yehuda rejected the test of the Tanakhama because Rashi says that it turns out to be a kula. The reason it's a kula is because we're speaking about tuma over here. And if you find a hole that's a kones mashkeh, then you're mitaher this item. It no longer has the same kli. even though it has etzad chumra as well, which is that it will be disqualified from being used for mechatat, that is a less common or less likely scenario where you need to be worried about it. The more common scenario is that you're dealing with a kli that you want to make sure is no longer tameh or will not become tameh, and therefore it turns out to be a kula in this case. Oh, he offers another test, which is shufta agabe aur. You put it on the flame. You put it on top of the stove top. If the fire stops the leaching of the liquids, then you know that it's only the size that allows liquid to leach out, not the size that allows liquid in. If the leak continues to happen and is visible despite the fire down below that's under it, then if the liquids still are coming out or still leaching out despite the heat and the fire that's under it, then that's a sign of machnis mashke. Or in essence, what he's saying is that small amounts of liquids that would leach out, the fire would cause those to evaporate, or the fire would stop it from exiting that hole because of the heat and the evaporation that would cause it not to exit from there. But that's only true if it was a small amount of liquid, which would be associated with the hole that allows liquids to leach out. If it's a hole that allows liquids to enter back in, then that hole is big enough that when liquid exiting, they would overwhelm the amount of heat or fire that's there, and you would still see liquids leaching out despite the fact that it's sitting on a fire. Rabbi Yossi Omer, af lo shuftal gabe aur. Rabbi Yossi rejects that view of Rabbi Yehuda and says, you can't put it on a stovetop, you can't put it over the fire. The fire is a very good retardant in terms of the leak over here. It will stop the liquids from coming out, even when the hole is bigger than that of just the motzi mashke, and so therefore it's not a good test. Ela shufta al gabe remetz, you put it on top of not an active fire, but you put it on top of embers. You put it on top of coals that are burning but don't have a flame on them, or you put them in ashes that still have the heat inside of them but don't have an active flame. So these are embers that are very hot, but they don't have an active flame. Im remetz mamida, if that mix of ashes and coals holds the liquid from coming out, biyadua shemotzi mashke, then you know that the hole is only the size that allows liquids to leach out. Bim lav, if not, biyadua shekones mashke, if the liquids still come out, then you know the hole is big enough to allow liquids in. Haya toreid tipa achar tipa. Now there is a statement here at the end of the braita, and it's not clear here where the attribution is. According to Rashi, it seems to me that it's a continuation of Rabbi Yossi's statement that this is another test. I gave you the test that's the modified test that Rabbi Yehuda gave with the remetz, and I'll offer you another option for a good test over here. That's the way Rashi reads it. Others say that it is a test that is accepted by everyone in the Mishnah, and it's a divrei hakol. Others say that it's not even a test, because if this was the test, they should have brought this first, because it's the easiest test to do. And rather, the statement here at the end of the Mishnah is indicating circumstantial evidence. This isn't a test, but if you see such a thing, you have a good idea of what the outcome of the test will be, and that will be a corroborating factor. If it is Torei Tipa, Char Tipa, if it drifts steadily, then Biyadua Shekones Mashke, then you know the hole is the size that would allow liquids in, because when it's leaching and leaking liquids, the liquids leach at a steady pace. Whereas if it comes out in a slower fashion, in a drip-drip fashion, then that's an indication that the hole is only big enough to allow liquids out, not big enough to allow liquids in. Ma'ika ben Tanakama le Rav Yehuda. What's the difference between the Tanakama and Rav Yehuda? Amar Ula explains, kinus ayidei dachak. When the liquids enter in the kli from the outside, konis mashkeh, when it's under duress, when it's under pressure, that's the difference between them. And that's what we explained before. And Rashi explained why Rabbi Yehuda rejected the Tanakama's position. That's exactly the nafkamina that Ula is saying between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yehuda, which is pressure fair when you're trying to test for Kones Mashke? According to the Tanakama, it's fine. Even though there's pressure adding to the force that would allow the liquid to enter, that would be a valid test. And therefore, you can test it by submerging the bottom of the kli that has a hole in it into a trough or utensil that already has the liquids in it. According to Rabbi Yehuda, that pressure is a kula because it allows the liquids to enter even then when it's not a kones mashke, and therefore you have to do it a test or an experiment where there is no pressure involved, where the kli is already face down in the trough or whatever you're trying to fill with water, and then you float the water on top of it until it reaches the level of the hole and you see if it leaks in when it's not under pressure, and that's the test. And that would obviously be a chumrah, because then it would be less likely to have that hole in it, and less likely to make it tahor. Kol eiver sheish bo tziporen. This is what we discussed in the Mishnah, that any eiver that has a nail in it is indicative of the fact that it has an etzem, that it has a bone in it. Yesh bo tziporen mitamei b'magav masa u'ohel. If it has a nail on it, then it's mitamei magan masa, which anything that is the size of an etzem kiseora, if it has a bone the size of a barley seed, will be tamei magal masa. The chiddush here is that it's also mitamei ma'ohel, that it also has tumat oil, despite the fact that it doesn't have a kezayit basar, despite the fact that it does not have all the qualifications of shiurim that you would require for tumat oil. The reason being is because it's classified as an aver, and an aver doesn't have those minimum requirements. It's chashuv in itself. The truth is that it's not enough for it just to have a tziporin, which would make it that it is now an aver. You need basar, gidim, and etzem. You need the whole aver to be whole in order for this to be true. The idea being that if it has a tziporin, if it has a nail on it, that's already an indicative that there is a bone inside for sure. If it has a bone inside, then you're most of the way there towards it being a whole aver, assuming that the basar and the gidim and the dam, everything is there together to make the whole Eiver. Yesh bo etzem, ve'ein bo tziporen. If this extra limb only has a bone in it, but does not have a nail on it, v'tamei b'magav masa, it is a part of a corpse of the mate, and therefore I have tumat hamate, etzem kiseora, will convey tumat hamate, ve'einu mitamei be'ohel. And it is not mitamei be'ohel, because you do not have an eiver shalem, or you do not have something that's classified as an eiver. As we're going to see in a second in the Gemara, we're speaking about an extra limb, because if it's not an extra limb, then it's mitameh ke'aver, even absent seemingly the tziporin, even absent the nail over here, because it's considered to be a whole aver. Amar Rav Chista, davar zeh rabbeinu agadol amarob. So this item that I'm about to tell you, I got this v'misor, as Rashi says, rabbeinu agadol is from Rav. Hamakom yeh be'ezro, because Baruch Hu should be to his assistance, or to take care of him. Etzba yitera, sheyesh bo etzem, ve'ein bo tziporen. A extra limb, extra finger, that has a bone in it, but does not have a nail. Mitamei b'magal masa, ve'ein mitamei b'ohel. It's mitamei b'magal masa, not b'ohel. So this is the indication that that which we were speaking about until now was an etzba yitera, because Rav specifically indicates that this case where the lack of tziporin is impactful in making it that it's not an aver and only mitameh b'magal masa is related to an etzba yitera. Amar Rabba Bar Chana Rabbi Yochanan, ukshe'ena nisperet agavayad. And that's only true when it's not in line with the other fingers that are on the hand. Whereas if it's in line with the other fingers that are on the hand, then it is considered to be an aver, even absent the tziporin. So this necessity for there to be a tziporin, which is indicative of the fact that there's an etzem in there, is only true when you have an extra limb, meaning an extra finger or extra digit, and in a case where it's not in line with the other five digits or fingers that are on the hand. In that case, then that extra piece is only considered to be an aver if it has a tziporin, which is then indicative of an etzem as well. But if it just has an etzem, then it would not be mitamei ke'aver or mitamei be'ohel. Elim Kane, it has a kezayit basar with it. If it has a kezayit basar, then it's mitamei because of the basar. Absent that, it will not be classified as an aver, but it will have tumat magal masa because of the etzem. And even though there is basar around it, either you have to say that the basar is considered to be a shomer or is considered to be a yad, and therefore the tumah of the etzem is conveyed through them, even though you're not touching the etzem directly. So Tosafot deals with that issue. It seems to be here that the tumah of this finger digit that's not on the line with the other fingers is all like gzeirat chachamim. It's gzeirat otu when the limb is on the same plane as the other fingers, or when it's just a regular finger, and therefore it's a gzeira she'enu nisperet al gaviyad atu nisperet, that the Gemara in Bechorot seems to indicate that this is all a gzeira for a finger that's not in line because of a finger that is in line. And the Gemara there differentiates and says that the reason it's only tamei magal masa is because we want to have a heker that is only a din derabonon. Therefore, we're not mitamei ba'ohel. So then Tosafot says, if that's the case, that it's only mitamei b'maga, then when you touch the basar, how do you have tumah? Because you're not in contact with the etzem, which is the cause of the tumah over here. And back in Chulin, we said that there isn't a yad for pachot mikazayit, and there's no shomer for pachot mikipul. Tosafot suggests over here, yesh lomar, the gazru chachamim, atu lefamim, yesh be'etzem kipul. Maybe the gzeret chachamim here is because sometimes the bone is the size of a pool, the size of a bean, a legume, and therefore you would have tumah here. Inami nigiat basar atu nigiat etzem, or the gzera here is because that we are gozer that when you touch the flesh, that you're tamei, because you might touch the bone, or gazru maga atu masa, or because when masa, when you carry it, you don't need to be in direct contact with it, which will make you tamei. And then Ritzamei Maga to Masa. Tosafot says over here that this Gezerat Chachamim has to overcome a number of deficits, and it does so by having whatever Gezera it is, onto the possibility that you would become Tamei, despite the fact that it doesn't meet the stringent requirements that we normally have for something to convey Tuma, Bederach Maga, because you're not in direct contact with the item. Okay, Kol HaMitamei Midras. Call the chazi the midras, mitamei, tamei mate. Anything that can accept tumat midras will also accept or can have be affected by tumat mate. V'yesh mitamei, tamei mate, main mitamei midras. But the opposite is not true. Just because something can accept tumat mate doesn't mean it will be tamei, tumat midras. La tuye mai. The distinction here, what is that coming to include? What is the case where it's mitamei, tumat mate, and it's not mitamei, tumat midras? Marzez la tuye. Sa'a v'tarkav. These are utensils that are used for measuring, dry measures of a sa'a, or tarkav, which is either tray plus a kav, three kav, because you have two and one, or from the word try, tri-kav, something that has three kav in it. There are six kav in a sa'a. This is basically a measure that is half a sa'a. The Tanya, v'ayoshev al-kli, so the one who sits on a kli, Yochol kafa sa'a b'yashav aleha, otar kav b'yashav aleha. If he turned over a utensil that used for measuring a sa'a, or one that's used for measuring three kav, someone sat on it, yehei tamei, you would think that would have tumat midras. Tamalomar, asher yeshev alav hazav, that which the zav sits on, mi shim yuchad l'shiva, only things that are designated particularly for sitting on, yatzazeh. Excluded from this is it, this particular kli, because shomrim lo amod v'naseh melachteinu, because we say to the zav, get up, and let us use this kli for its proper utility, its proper designation. So what the Gemara is pointing out over here is that tumat midras only applies to things that normally are sat on, or normally that are laid on. If you sit on something or lay on something which has other utility, and we would say to the zav, get up, and leave this utensil alone, because we want to use it for its proper utility, its proper designation, then that kli will not mekabel tumat midras. Rashi in the Gemara in Shabbat, and Daf Nun Tet Amud Aleph, explains that limud comes from, some bring it from the pasuk that's actually quoted over here, which is, Hayoshev ala kli, asher yeshev alav hazav, which makes it sound like that he sat on a kli, asher yeshev alav hazav, that normally the zav would sit on, meaning that's something that's designated, or is associated with being sat on. So you sit on a kli that normally is sat on by the zav. That extra lashon of asher yeshev alav would teach you that it has to be something that normally is sat on. Rashi brings that as the perush of the Talmidim and rejects that because he says the Gemara has other drashot from that pasuk. And therefore Rashi offers the alternative, which is kol mishkav asher yishkav alav azav yitma v'chol kli asher yeshev alav yitma. And it's interesting, the language in the pasuk. It doesn't say kol mishkav asher shachalav alav azav. It doesn't say anything that he laid upon. And it doesn't say v'chol kli asher yashav alav in the past tense. Rather, it has the verb and the active sense, which is kol mishkav, anything that he lays upon, asher yishkav alav, that he continues to lay upon or he will lay upon. And same thing, kol kli asher yashav alav, that he will continue to sit on, or he will in the future sit on, that teaches you that it has to be a kli that in the general or in the future will also have this same utility, which is that you're laying on something that you would lay on in the future, that you would continue to lay on, or you sit on something that you will sit on in the future, or you will continue to sit on in the future. And that would only be true if that's the designation of this kli. If we say to you, listen, I got to measure something, get up off the chair and you got to use it, that's already an indication that that's not what you're going to be doing in the future. That's not going to be the continuous state that you're in, because you would be bumped off of it for its primary utility. And therefore, those types of kelim are not mekabel tumat midras, but obviously they would be mekabel tumat hamet. Right now, the next Mishnah continues with this genre, which is kol ra'ui ladun dinei nefashot. Anyone who can adjudicate cases that involve capital punishment, ra'ui ladun dinei memonot, then they can deal with or judge or adjudicate monetary matters. V'yesh ra'ui ladun dinei memonot. On the other hand, there are people who are qualified to adjudicate monetary matters, v'enu ra'ui ladun dinei fashot, but they would not be qualified to be part of a beit din that is adjudicating a capital case. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda says about our Mishnah, letuye mamzer. Our Mishnah comes to include a mamzer, which means that a mamzer would be kasher the dinei memonot, but he would not be kasher the dinei nefashot, and that is because of the pasuk that they quote in Sanhedrin from Shir Shirim, kulach yafa ra'ayati umumein bach. And so from there they learn that the individual can't have a mum in them in order to be a part of the beit din, and as Rashi says, that being a mamzer is a type of mum, and therefore you're disqualified. Or the Gemara brings another source, because it says in Parshat Balotcha, when Moshe asks for help, and Hashem grants him the additionals of Kenim, it says there in Perakud Aleph, Pasuk Yudzayin, V'yaradati, V'dibarti mecha sham, V'atzalti min aruach asher alecha, V'samti alehem, V'nasu itecha b'masa ha'am, V'lo tisa ata levadecha. And the Gemara dashens, V'nasu itecha, that they have to be V'domim lecha, and miyuchasim kamotcha. And with you means like you. Just like you don't have any psulim and you don't have any mumim, so too those that sit on the Sanhedrin with regards to at least the Sanhedrin that has a minimum of 23 in it, which can deal with capital cases, there you have that requirement that those judges be domim lecha, be similar to Moshe Rabbeinu, that they have yichus and they don't have any mumim, or from the pasuk in Shir Shirim that's quoted in Sanhedrin, that ain't mumein bach, that you have no mum in you, so that's a qualification. A mamzer doesn't have that, and therefore he can't sit in a case of dinei nefashot. On the other hand, for dinei memonot, there is no such requirement, and therefore he can adjudicate a case that involves dinei memonot. The Gemara says, but tanina chadazimna, didn't we already bring this before? Meaning that we have a Mishnah that is in Sanhedrin that already tells us the exact same thing that you have in our Mishnah over here. Everyone is qualified to adjudicate monetary matters, but not everybody is qualified to adjudicate capital cases. And over there we ask the same question. What does that come to include? Who is qualified by mimonot and not by nefashot? Comes to include a mamzer. Now the Baalei HaTosafot point out that the question of the Gemara seems a little bit strange. It says, don't we have this in another Mishnah? Why doesn't the Gemara ask that about every other item that is mentioned in these Mishnayot over here? There are many items here that are mentioned in this Mishnah, mentioned in Mishnayot, in their proper Masechta. They're brought over here because of the genre, but they're not brought here because they're topically relevant, but they are brought also in their Masechta. And how come the Gemara doesn't ask that about any of the other items here? Tanei Yichad HaZimna. And Tosafot points out numerous other places in Shas, we have duplications of Mishnayot. One in the location where it's topically relevant, and another one either because it's in a list of halachot that are relevant, or have a common denominator between them, or a genre or style that is common between them, and you see duplication all the time. The Gemara doesn't say, Tanina Chadazimna. So Tosafot says here, he doesn't think the Gemara's question is from duplication of the Mishnah, rather the question of the Gemara here is about Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda in both cases says Latuye Mamzer. Why does he need to tell us twice that it's coming to include a Mamzer? One of these cases would have been sufficient to tell us that information. That's the question of the Gemara. Why does Rabbi Yehuda include Mamzer in both of these cases? My answer is Chada Letuye Ger, Chada Letuye Mamzer. One of them comes to include a Ger, that he is Kasher, and one of them is coming to include a Mamzer, that he is qualified. And the Balei Tosafot point out that Rabbi Yehuda's statement is about the Dinei Mimonot side of it. He's not coming to tell you who's disqualified from Dinei Nefashot. He's coming to tell you who's qualified for Dinei Mimonot. And you can see that in the Tzrichuta coming up now, which is the Tzricha. We need both a Mamzer and a Ger. Diashmin and Ger, Mishum Deravu Ilavo Bekal. The reason I think a Ger is qualified for Dinei Mimonot is because he's allowed to marry into Klal Yisrael. Of a Mamzer, then Roy Ilavo Bekal, Emelo. But a Mamzer who can't marry into a regular Yisrael, because he is a Mamzer, maybe he should be disqualified from doing Dinei Mimonot. So therefore I tell you, Mamzer also can adjudicate Dinei Mimonot. V'yashmina Mamzer, had you just mentioned Mamzer, Mishum Dekaate Mitipak Shira. He comes from Zera Kodosh. He comes from Yisraelim. And therefore maybe that's what qualifies him to adjudicate monetary matters. Avadeir Dekaate Mitipak Sula. His creation was a creation from those that were not part of Klal Yisrael, even though he converted later. So he is a Jew, but his origins are not that of a Yisrael. Maybe that would disqualify him, Emelo. Maybe it would disqualify him from adjudicating Dinei Mimonot. Tzricha, we need both of them to teach us that both a Mamzer and a Ger are qualified to do Dinei Mimonot, even though, as we know, they will not be qualified to do Dinei Nefashot. And that's what the Mishnah came to include. There are some people who can adjudicate monetary matters, but not capital cases. And we have the Mishnah twice. And Rabbi Yehuda both times makes a statement, it's to include. And one time it's to include a Mamzer, one time to include a Ger. And we need both of those because one could not be learned from the other. Tosafot over here discusses the issue of Ger, which he brings up in other places, which is, what type of Ger are we speaking about here? Because he says, Mashma de Kosher, Afagav de Enig Mod Yisrael. Sounds from like this Gemara, that if he's a complete convert over here, even though his mother is not from Klal Yisrael, they could still be part of a Beit Din that's adjudicating monetary matters. Tosafot is bothered by that because in the Gemara in Yevamot, there it says, Rova allowed Mari Barachel to be amongst those in the leadership in Bavel because his mother was Jewish. And therefore he was called Mikerev Achecha. It sounds like that you need to at least have a mother from Israel in order to be qualified for these types of jobs or these types of appointments. How could it be here that the Gemara says that a pure ger can be appointed to be a judge in a beit that adjudicates monetary matters? So Tosafot over here says, V'yesh lomar d'hacha mairi ladun ger chaveiro. But over here, he only has the right to adjudicate cases of gerim, not necessarily of Yisraelim. And that's what he says here, that he quotes, ger dan chaveiro dvar Torah. A ger can adjudicate cases min haTorah of another ger. And if his mother is from Israel, then he can even adjudicate a case that involves a regular Israel. Rashi, in the Gemara there in Yevamot, suggests that that's speaking about Dinei Nefashot and not Dinei Mimonot. Tosafot rejects Rashi's explanation and says that it's a reference to the Dinei Mimonot. And then Tosafot suggests that the possibility that even maybe if he's a full ger, he can still adjudicate cases, if the people accept him as a judge, meaning basically making it to arbitration rather than adjudication, and maybe that's the scenario where a complete ger could be part of such a beit din based on other rayot that the Tosafot brings, that we do seem to find complete gerim were part of batei dinim. And so he says, either you have to suggest in those cases that the cases involve another ger, or that maybe the people accepted that individual as a judge or as an arbitrator. The next Mishnah, Kola Kasher Ladun, Kasher La'id. Anybody who can adjudicate can be on a Beit Din as a judge, then he can also be a witness. V'yesh Kasher La'id, there's some people that are kasher to be witnesses, Veina Kasher Ladun, but they don't have the right to sit on a Beit Din. La'atuye Mai, what does that come to include? I'm Rabbi Yochanan La'atuye Suma Be'achat Me'enav. It is to include a scenario where this individual is blind in one eye. Umani, and who's the author of that position? Rabbi Meir he. That is Rabbi Meir's position, which we'll discuss in the Gemara tomorrow as to what is unique about Rabbi Meir's position, whereby he says that a person cannot be a judge if he's blind even in one eye. But obviously if he's blind in one eye, he can't be a witness because he is ra'ah. He saw. He witnessed the event. Since he witnessed the event, he can't testify as an aid. But he can't be a judge, because we'll see tomorrow in the Braita that Rabbi Meir has a hekesh that disqualifies someone who is blind in one eye from being a judge. What many of the Rishonim deal with here, and in many other places in Shas with regards to this matter, is the issue of Devorah. Devorah was shofetet at Israel. She was adjudicating, she was judging, and she was kasher ladun, it seems like. Yet she's clearly not kshera as an aid, because women are disqualified from being aidim. So how does that fit into this principle that the Mishnah has, which is called a kasher ladun, kasher lahaid? So Tosafot over here brings a couple of answers. In other places in Shas he brings more answers. He says, first of all, over here, the possibility is that women are kasherot to be judges. Just like they are subject to the dinim, like men, and on equal footing with men, so too they can judge on equal footing into being a judge, just like men. And the Mishnah is just not applicable. It's as if the Mishnah said, "Kol kasher be'ish ladun, kasher be'ish la'id." It's as if the Mishnah is qualifying itself and saying, this is only true by men, this is not true by women, because women have a different din, where they can't be judges, and they cannot be a din. Then Tosafot brings another alternative, which is maybe women are disqualified from being judges, but over here, Devorah was an Neviah, and she was being done al pi ha'dibur. She was adjudicating based on the heavenly inspiration that she had as being a prophetess. And that's what gained her the right to be a judge. Not because in a normal situation she would have been qualified as a judge. This is unique to Devorah because she has a unique standing as a prophetess. That's another answer that they give. Inami, they give a third answer, which is she would teach the dinim. She wasn't actually adjudicating cases. She taught the judges how to judge, or she gave them the information. She was a teacher, but she was not a judge herself. In other places in Shas, the Baal HaTosafot offered another alternative, which is Kiblu Alayu. The people accepted her as a judge. She became an arbitrator rather than a judge, because the people accepted her judgments, or they accepted her adjudicating the cases, and then she was a judge, not because, again, she qualified to be a judge, but because the people wanted her to be their judge, and they accepted her decisions as being binding arbitration. And that's how she was able to be a judge. And again, all of these answers are trying to reconcile between Devorah being a judge and what the Mishnah seems to say, it would be impossible that she could be a judge, because since she's disqualified from being an aide, she should also be disqualified from being a judge. How do we then reconcile with Devorah being a judge if she's disqualified from being a judge? So the Baal HaTosafot started out with the answer that maybe she can't be a judge, and this is only talking about men and not women. Although the majority of his answers follow that the woman is clearly disqualified, and in this case, Devorah was unusual, and we explained all the different reasons why Devorah's case might be exceptional. Okay, we're going to stop here by the top line of Nun Amud Aleph.